All right, 1 Samuel chapter number 27. What's been taking place, of course, is Saul's been chasing after David. And he's going after David to try to kill him and find him. And David, of course, has some opportunities to actually vindicate himself and take vengeance on Saul. But he doesn't use those opportunities. He says, I can't touch the Lord's anointed. And he backs off. And this last confrontation that he had with Saul, David made some comments regarding how that God was going to take care of him. And basically, he doesn't trust Saul. You can tell from chapter 26, he's like, you know, Saul says, I've played the fool, I've erred, and you're going to rule, and so on and so forth. But David doesn't trust him for a minute, and you can't blame David. And so they leave that meeting there in the cave in chapter 26. And chapter 27 is kind of a sad chapter when you think about it devotionally. Because what you have in chapter 27 is David falling and caving under the pressure. And he goes to join the Philistines. The very group of people that he had fought as a general. And he had fought against Goliath, which was a Philistine, the enemy of God. Now he joins God's enemies. And it's from the pressure. And I can't imagine the pressure not just on himself, but he's putting all the other men and all the other people under that pressure with Saul. And so finally, he just basically caves in. And notice what he says in chapter 27, verse number 1. David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines. And Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more in any coast of Israel. So shall I escape out of his hand. Turn over to the book of Ecclesiastes, right after the book of Proverbs. Notice this reasoning here is between him and himself. There's no spiritual prayer going on. He's not asking counsel of God. Ecclesiastes chapter number 2. When you read the book of Ecclesiastes, you have the book of wisdom written by the smartest man in the world, the wisest man, and he writes this book as a man sees things under the sun. He's just looking out and says, okay, this is how I see it. You know, this is my opinion as just a man under the sun without supernatural revelation. And he goes through this thing and he makes several statements here. Notice in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Look down in verse number 24. Ecclesiastes 2. Look at his reasoning back up to verse number 22. For what hath man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows, and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This is also vanity. He says, here's this guy, he labors, he works, and he just works himself to the bone, and then all he has is things to worry about. You know, the more stuff you have, the more you have to worry about. Go ahead and get a lot of annuities and stocks and bonds and all those things. You know what you're going to be doing? You're going to be looking at those papers. You're going to be looking at those things. You're going to be worrying about that stuff. The more stuff you get down here, the more you're going to be pulled to it and worried over it. Then notice what he says in verse number 24. There is nothing better for man. Here you go. What's the best thing you can do? Than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God. There is nothing better according to who? All right, come over to chapter 3. David says, there's nothing better for me than to go to the Philistines. Some people say, well, there's nothing better for me than to move and go to this place. So, okay, well, let's look at it spiritually. Where are you going to be in your walk with God? What church are you going to go to? Yeah, blank, 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 blank. People don't even think about their spiritual life. They think, there's nothing better for me to do than to retire and get me a place over here. I'm going to buy me a little house in the mountains. Okay, where are you going to go to church? Well, I'm just going to YouTube it. I'm just going to watch it live. Okay. Well, don't expect me to come up there and go to the hospital with you because I ain't doing it. You can find a virtual preacher. I guess you can get on virtual chat with somebody and have them pray for you. Do your funeral up there virtually. But you got this crazy thing where American Christians are so carnal, everything now is just about their flesh. Well, if it's easier for me to go to the Philistines, I'm just going to go to the Philistines. If I can make more money, I'm going to quit coming to church on Sunday. I can get overtime because it's all about me. It's all about my flesh. That's how people think. That's how Christians think. They're not spiritually minded. They're carnally minded. Now look in Ecclesiastes chapter number 3. Here's the same thing. Solomon says, there's nothing better than to eat and drink. Look in Ecclesiastes 3, come down to the end of the chapter. Verse 22. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? Just live in the present. Live in the now. All right, come back to 1 Samuel 27. Now David said in his heart, you see that? Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, what's the classic verse? Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, lean not to thine own understanding. Proverbs, there's another passage of Proverbs, maybe chapter 16, I don't know the reference. He that trusteth in his own heart is a fool. Because your own heart can pull you aside. You can be tricked, you can be deceived, you can just look out for yourself. You cannot look at the spiritual thing. That's why the Proverbs admonishes us, in the multitude of counselors there's wisdom. Sometimes you need to get somebody from the outside to assess the situation, because you're in the middle of it and you can't see it. You're in the fog, you're just looking around. And so you can say, there's nothing better for me to do. This is the way out. And the reason you're making those statements is because of all the pressure on you. That's what David's doing. He's going to lose 16 months with the Philistines. And he's going to get in a compromising situation where he is going to be in a place where he possibly could be fighting against God's own people. Rough situation here. But notice in verse number 2, David arose, 1 Samuel 27, 2, David arose and he passed over with the 600 men that were with him unto Achish, the son of Maoch, king of Gath. It's in the Philistines' land. David dwelt with Achish of Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's wife. And it was told Saul that David was fled to Gath. Here we go. And he sought no more again for him. The pressure comes off. Surely that was the will of God. Like a pressure cooker, you know. We had one of those things blow up one time, so we don't use them anymore. It was defective or something, you know. Those things are dangerous. You can get hurt bad with those things. But you can take the pressure off, and if you give in to the devil and you give in to the world, you can get a little relief. You can get out of the fight and get a little relief, but I'm telling you, in the long run, you're going to pay for it. Best thing to do is to stay in the fight. The best thing to do is do what God tells you to do. Don't just let off, slack off. The pressure comes off, but boy, he's getting in a mess here. Verse number 5. David said unto Achish, if I have now found grace in thine eyes, let them give me a place in some town in the country, that I may dwell there. For why should thy servant dwell in the royal city with thee? I mean, he's got a pretty good group of folks. 600 men plus the wives and kids. I don't know, probably close to 2,000 folks are with him, at least. Later on, we're going to see, if we run the cross-reference in Chronicles, there's some folks from up north in Manasseh that come and join David's group whenever the battle comes against the Philistines, so he could have possibly had upwards to 3,000 and 4,000 people. That's a whole city. And so he says, give me a place, you know, let me get away, you know. I mean, he's not supposed to be around these Philistines. The Jews are supposed to be separate from all the other nations. And here he is right in the middle of them. Verse number 6, and Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Wherefore Ziklag pertaineth unto the kings of Judah. This is someone writing, of course, after the fact. Now, when you run the reference in Joshua, I got it in the notes there, Joshua 19. Let me see if that's the right one. Joshua 19:5, it talks about this area. Yeah, Ziklag. You read about the conquest that Joshua took place when he went into the land. So it was taken by the Israelites. And Ziklag will be, of course, in Judah. That's probably on the maps up here. Just not on our map. But Ziklag is an area in Judah, and this is what Achish gives him, so he stays there. Notice verse number 7. And the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was a full year and 4 months. 16 months, he's basically in the world, if you want devotional application. Verse 8, David and his men went up and invaded the Geshurites and the Gezrites and the Amalekites. For those nations were of old, the inhabitants of the land, as thou goest to Shur, even unto the land of Egypt. That'll be going down south. Verse 9, and David smote the land and left neither man nor woman alive, and took away the sheep and the oxen and the asses and the camels and the apparel, and returned and came to Achish. Now come over to 1 Chronicles 3, get two places. 1 Chronicles 3 and 2 Samuel 13. 1 Chronicles 3 and 2 Samuel 13. And notice that David meets another woman here at this place. It doesn't tell us in 1 Samuel, but he gets him another wife. Look in 2 Samuel 13. 2 Samuel 13 and 1 Chronicles 3. 1 Chronicles chapter number 3, first part of the chapter there, verse 1. Now these were the sons of David which were born unto him in Hebron. The first, Amnon of Ahinoam the Jezreelitess. The second, Daniel of Abigail the Carmelitess. The third, here it is, verse 2, Absalom the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah the son of Haggith. So the king of Geshur, so he invaded the Geshurites. And he finds him a woman there, and he has a son by him, and his name is Absalom. Now come over to 2 Samuel 13. Now when Absalom grows up, if you remember the story of David, and we'll get into it later when we study 2 Samuel, David's got all kinds of problems because of these polygamous relationships. And one of his sons, Amnon, he wants to basically marry his half-sister, Tamar, and he winds up raping her. And Absalom never forgives him, and Absalom wants to find a way to kill him. And of course, there's this situation that takes place where he does get the king's sons to go with him to the sheep shearing, and they kill Amnon. And then when he comes back, Absalom, he flees, and he takes off out of the land because David's mad about it, of course. But notice in 2 Samuel 13 where Absalom goes. Verse 37. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. So he goes back where his mother was from. So this shows you David's out of the will of God, and he has this relationship and gets him another wife outside of the will of God in the land of the Philistines, and has a son. And what does Absalom wind up doing? Absalom is the one who rebels and gets all these people to follow him and almost overthrows the entire kingdom. David has to leave Jerusalem, and there's a coup, if you will, and this huge rebellion that takes place, and all kind of tragedy comes from this situation. So back in 1 Samuel 27, now we would do well to take note that sin will take you further than you want to go, like the old saying is. It'll keep you longer than you want to stay, and it'll pay you. It pays more than you want that you'll get back. I forget how the saying goes. What's the last one? Cost you more than you want to pay. And so David winds up paying for this 16 months of being backslid. And he has this son, and of course it's going to come back to haunt him and many more in the kingdom. All right, come back to 1 Samuel 13. So he invades these people. Now notice he's killing these pagans. These are the Gentiles. These are the folks that God's actually given over to the nation of Israel to inhabit their land. So David is doing some conquest, if you will. Verse number 9, so he smote the land and left neither man nor woman alive. Now that's not brutal. That's actually God's command that he gave when they conquested the land of the nations that inherited the land of Canaan. And notice that he takes away the sheep, everything. Look in verse 10. It shows you why he does all this. And Achish said, "Whither have you made a road today?" And David said, "Against the south of Judah, against the south of the Jehormelites, against the south of the Kenites." He doesn't tell him, he tells him about south, but he doesn't give him the specifics of who he's actually whipping up on. Verse number 11, and David said, "Neither man nor woman alive to bring tidings to Gath, saying, lest they should tell on us, saying, so did David, and so will be his manner all the while he dwelleth in the country of the Philistines. And Achish believed David, saying, he hath made his people Israel utterly to abhor him, therefore he shall be my servant forever." He gives the impression that he's an enemy of Israel now, and he's on the side of the Philistines, but in actuality, he's not. He hasn't killed any Israelites. And he's made this road. That's the only time the word road appears in the Bible. God wants us to go on a path, not a road. A road's an easy, convenient way. A path is a difficult thing. He says, come back to the old paths, Jeremiah chapter 6. So here's this road, and he's destroying the enemies of Israel, and he's lying. He's having to cover some things up here. So he's giving an impression. He's telling like a partial truth. He went down the south and down in that area. And so Achish believes him, and everything seems to be good between him and David. All right, chapter 28. And it came to pass in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for warfare. to fight with Israel. And Achish said unto David, know thou assuredly that thou shalt go out with me to battle, thou and thy men. He's just touching base with David. You know, you're an Israelite. These are your people. We're about to fight them. Now you're one of our citizens. You're one of us, right? We're good. Us and you. You're on our team, right? Just double checking with David. It's been 16 months, but verse 2, and David said to Achish, surely thou shalt know what thy servant can do. And Achish said to David, therefore will I make thee keeper of mine head forever. Almost like his own personal captain of the guard. Keeper of his head. He would protect Achish, the king of Gath. He'd be his number one general. Verse 3. Now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, even in his own city. And Saul had put away those that had familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. Now why did Saul do this? Did he do this because he was so spiritual? I don't know. Did he do this because he was trying to follow the Old Testament law? Maybe, but he might have done it way back under the influence of Samuel. Samuel probably put the pressure and said, look, you don't need to do this. You don't need to let these people, because God gave commandment. Turn over to the Old Testament. Look at this. Go to the book of Leviticus. He gave specific instructions about these wicked things. It's a good day to preach this. Got a bunch of Christians celebrating the devil's day. Missed church on Sunday night to trick or treat. Leviticus 19. Look at Leviticus 19 toward the end of the chapter. He gives all these rules about going into the land. You have to understand, the Abrahamic covenant, God gives the Jew ownership of the land. Under the Palestinian covenant, that word Palestini is used a few times in the King James Bible, which is very insightful because of the modern usage of the word Palestine. He gives them this covenant to occupy the land. And under the Palestinian covenant, there are rules and regulations. And God says, if you do this, you'll be blessed. If you don't, I'll boot you out of the land. Excuse me. And they don't follow God's rules. They do not follow the statutes and judgments. They're supposed to keep the Sabbath every 7 years. So God boots them out of the land eventually. That doesn't mean they don't own it. And He's going to restore them to the land just like He promises in the covenants. But notice some of the stipulations He tells them. You got to imagine, they're going into the land of paganism. They're going into a land where these people worship devils and all kind of things. And so He gives them all these rules. Come down to the end of the chapter. Verse 34, but the stranger that dwelleth with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and thou shalt love him as thyself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. You shall do no unrighteousness. I didn't miss my reference. Come up. Verse number 31. Regard not them that have familiar spirits, neither them that neither seek after wizards to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God. So He says, regard them not. Notice also Deuteronomy. Actually, you're in Leviticus 19. Look in the next chapter, chapter 20. The last verse. 20:27. Leviticus 20:27. A man also or woman that hath a familiar spirit or that is a wizard shall surely be put to death. They shall stone them with stones. Their blood shall be upon them. Look in Deuteronomy 18. Now, this doesn't justify the Salem witch trials where you have these Puritans and these Protestants that try to set up a church state. You had Catholicism try to set up church state in America, but you also had the Protestants. Protestants are the ones who publicly beat the Baptists. Before we were a real country in 17, whatever it was, I don't know, Obadiah Holmes and those guys, maybe the 1740s, I don't know, don't quote me on that. But they publicly, that's the Protestants. You don't have a license. I would side with a pilgrim over a Puritan. Puritan's different than a pilgrim. See, a Puritan's trying to set up and try to make everybody what they do. You got to have Sabbath laws. Nobody can work on the Sabbath. No, everybody's got to do this. Everybody has to be sprinkled as a baby because that puts you in the church. Mm-mm. Baptist comes along and says the only people that can be in the church are those who are saved and make a confession of faith. Baptism follows belief. Big difference in Protestantism and true Christianity when you break it down like that, because they try to set up church states. And the great thing about America, how the thing was set up, is separation of church and state. The state does not force people to believe certain things. All right, look in Deuteronomy chapter number 18, this thing about the wizards. So if you don't rightly divide the Bible, then the Old Testament is just as applicable now as it was then. You see what I'm going with that? In other words, you better not eat bacon this morning. because Jew ain't supposed to eat bacon. And if you're the Jew, if the Israel is now the church, then how come we're here on Sunday instead of Saturday? How come we don't have an altar where we sacrifice a lamb? And how come we don't kill witches? It's a good night to find some. You can't try to take the Old Testament and shove it into the New Testament. In the New Testament, after the cross, you don't find Christians killing people because they don't believe what they believe. That's an Old Testament theocracy under the Jewish political regime that God set up to take over a physical piece of ground by warfare. That's not New Testament Christianity. We are preaching a spiritual kingdom, not a physical kingdom. That's why we're not all tied up in politics trying to get somebody elected because we think we're going to make America some kind of Christian nation. America's headed to hell. Best thing we can do is try to tell people how to be saved to get them delivered from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of His dear Son. So you got to understand that very practical dynamic between the Old Testament and New Testament. I'm glad I'm not an Old Testament Jew under the Old Testament law. And you're really messed up if you're a New Testament Christian trying to bring everybody back under that Old Testament theocracy. We are not under a Reconstructionist type of theology where we're trying to convert the world. America got kind of messed up with that stuff during some of the great revivals. Before you hit World War I and World War II, you had a lot of post-millennial thinking where they had a lot of great revivals, so they determined, look, we've already made it illegal to open up businesses on Sunday, so we're going to go ahead and take the thing a step further. We're going to outlaw cursing and swearing. And they did. Put 10 commandments on the wall, and they did. What good did it do? Well, look at the 20s. Things started coming back and hitting them in the face. Look at the 30s and the 40s. It came back. You cannot force and legislate spirituality. You will produce a bunch of half-breeds, if you want to call it that, or you'll produce people with a false birth. It's not a real birth. And you get a bunch of people that are religious that want to rule by rigor instead of people that are spiritual. Anyway, let me get back to this. Deuteronomy chapter 18, look at this thing in the Old Testament. Come down to verse number 9. He goes through. When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not learn to do after the abomination of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that useth divination, or an observer of times. Look at the astrology thing in the paper. Or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For all that do those things are abomination unto the Lord. Because of these abominations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee. Verse 14, for these nations which thou shalt possess hearken unto the observers of times and unto the diviners, but as for thee, the Lord thy God hath not suffered thee to do so. So when God told them to go into the land and wipe all these people out, it wasn't that God was just mean to all these innocent people. He was judging those people for their wickedness and their abominations. So this thing about familiar spirit, you see the word family in it. Familiar spirit. So it's got family in it. And so it has to do with someone that has a connection. To be familiar with something is to be, if you're familiar with someone, you may know them on a close level. To be in the family is to be connected. So oftentimes, someone bringing up a familiar spirit, you go to a house and you find out, you know, Monticello is known to be the ghost capital of Florida, right? We're the ghost capital. You know, the one thing, you look up Monticello and it's all about ghosts. You can have a ghost tour. And we'll find a real spooky house and you sit around, you get all these people to sit around and you hold hands, you put a candle, you say, you know, it's very, you say, someone way back died in this house. Of course. People didn't die in hospitals and they weren't born. A lot of babies died in houses too. There was an infant that died in this house. Well, chances are 9 times out of 10 in houses that are 200 years or older, they're going to be an infant that died in the house. You go back and say, well, the lady was true. There was an infant that died in this house. But the Lord's against that stuff. Now here's a couple things to think about it. You have the devil that's able to manipulate and use these things back in Old Testament times and certain times where God gives him permission to bridge those gaps because he definitely does know things beyond the natural human realm. But you also have, in our modern time, people that without any visible, proven supernatural phenomenon in front of them will believe things. It's unbelievable. You can have no physical proof at all, but they can be so convinced and so deceived. People believe what they want to believe, especially when they start investing a lot of time and money in something. All right, come back to 1 Samuel 28. So this familiar spirit, it has to do with someone conjuring up. He mentions in the book of Isaiah, if you want to jot the reference, Isaiah 8:19 and Isaiah 29:4. Isaiah 29:4, he mentions about a spirit peeping out of the ground and muttering out of the ground, almost like there's ventriloquism going on. I don't know if the person was acting like this, the spirit is talking. Maybe they're able to project their voice. I don't know. Or you actually have where Satan is doing demonic work from this. Now, come back to 1 Samuel 28 and notice that Saul has already put these people out of the land. Whether it was the influence of Samuel or not, we don't know. And then notice he's going to go after this familiar spirit. Verse number 4. And the Philistines gathered themselves together and came and pitched in Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel together and they pitched in Gilboa. And when Saul saw the host of the Philistines, he was afraid and his heart greatly trembled. And when Saul inquired of the Lord answered him not, neither by dreams, nor by Urim, nor by prophets. Remember Jacob, how he had that dream in Genesis 29? He saw the ladder going to heaven. God answered him by a dream and showed him something by a dream. Over in the book of Job, Job 33:14-18. Job 33, he talks about in the dreams, God hides man from his purpose. And he talks about how God might use dreams. It seems like in the Muslim community, there's a big focus on dreams. I've read testimonies of a lot of people in the Muslim community, and I don't know how the Lord even might use this nowadays. But I've heard of testimonies of Muslims that they have some dream about Jesus and that prompts them to be interested in it. You know, more than one. Because a lot of their spiritual life is based on dreams. If I base my spiritual life on dreams, it would be weird. I'm sure everybody has weird dreams. I have some wild dreams. I don't even want to talk about them. And just strange stuff, you know. But you can't base your life on dreams. You got to be real careful with that. But back in the Old Testament, God most certainly spoke through dreams and visions. Remember Balaam, the prophet. God gave Balaam these visions, and he had his eyes open. He was in a trance, and he began to utter these words about the prophecy of the nation of Israel. So you see that a lot in the Bible. And then notice he mentions also in verse number 6, God hasn't answered him by dreams nor by Urim. Urim, that has to do with the lights that was in the ephod. And remember, David's got the ephod because Abiathar came down with the ephod in his hand. So he doesn't have that. He can't inquire by the priests because he slew the priests there at Nob. He killed all those guys. So even if he has any priests around, they don't have the ephod with that Urim, and it had those stones in it. And somehow that thing lit up. And those stones represented the letters of each tribe. Somehow that thing would spell something out. I don't understand it. That's the closest guess that we have. That thing somehow lit up and you were able to take the letters and get an answer from it. Then he says, nor by prophets. Of course, Samuel's dead, and he's not giving him any answer. So what does Saul do? Verse number 7, he's got to get some answers. Then Saul said unto his servant, seek me a woman that hath a familiar spirit, that I may go to her and inquire of her. Why does he say a woman? Why didn't he say a man? I guess a man's a wizard and a woman's a witch. Is that right? Is that how it is? The witch is a... I don't know. Now in science fiction now, they got all these good witches and bad witches. And that's kind of like how the New Bibles use the word demon instead of devils. You know, in Greek mythology and stuff, there are good demons. The Bible uses the term devils specifically to point back to the devil, not a demon. Matter of fact, the word demon is from daimonon, the Greek word. That is not a translation. That's a transliteration. So they're not even translating the word. The translation's devils. So he's seeking after a woman. You ever thought about the false prophets? Mary Baker Eddy, Amy Simple McPherson with the charismatic movement, Catherine Coleman. You ever thought about Ellen G. White with the Seventh-day Adventist? A lot of the women that are associated with some of the cult movements. There's a lot of that. Seek me a woman that hath a familiar spirit that I may go to her and inquire of her. And his servant said to him, behold, there is a woman that hath a familiar spirit at Endor. So she's called the witch at Endor. And Saul disguised himself and put on other raiment, and he went, and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night. And he said, I pray thee, divine unto me. Just like, remember, Joseph had that cup, and he put it in Benjamin's sack, and he says, this is the cup by which I divine, from that word divinity, from the word traced back to the word dios, has to do with God, to tell the future. Divine unto me by the familiar spirit, and bring me him up whom I shall name unto thee. And the woman said unto him, behold, thou knowest what Saul hath done, how he hath cut off those that have familiar spirits and the wizards out of the land. Wherefore then layest thou a snare for my life to cause me to die? And Saul sware to her by the Lord, saying, as the Lord liveth, there shall no punishment happen to thee for this thing. So she doesn't know he's Saul. He's disguised himself. Now, she's not too sharp. I'm going to find somebody to tell me all these, give me these spirits and stuff. Surely they'd be able to tell who I am. You know, I always look at these palm reader places. They're these little shacks by the road. They don't have enough money to cut their grass, you know. And they're supposed to have all this. Surely they could win a few lotteries, you know, and get them some money. Why do they got to charge all these prices? It's a bunch of foolishness is what it is. But she doesn't know who he is, and he disguises himself. Notice he mentions a phrase in verse 8. He says, bring me up, whom I name unto thee. The spirits come up from the ground. They don't come up from heaven. All right, notice, let's go ahead and run these references. Go over to Genesis 50. What you want to understand from the Old Testament, before the cross, even when righteous people died, they didn't go directly into the third heaven. They didn't go up. They went down. Genesis chapter 50. Notice here with Jacob, looking 49, the last chapter, last part of verse 49, Genesis chapter 49, verse number 33. And when Jacob had made an end of commanding his sons, he gathered up his feet into the bed and yielded up the ghost. Look at this. And was gathered unto his people. Chapter 50, Joseph fell upon his face, kissed him. He commanded the physicians to embalm him. 40 days, verse number 3. So 49:33 has nothing to do with him being buried. He said in verse 5, I got to bury my father in Canaan. So they get up and they march all the way to Canaan to bury him. Gathered unto his people is a phrase you read about in the Old Testament. And so if we were to try to peel back what the Bible describes as the nether world, you read about it a couple of times in Ezekiel. Let me give you the references. You can jot them down if I wrote them down. Yeah, Ezekiel 31:14 and 32:18. Ezekiel 31:14, 32:18. It's called the nether world in the Old Testament. So let's just say the cross is here. So in the Old Testament, you have hell. You have a place called Abraham's bosom, the separate, underneath. And you also have a place, I believe there are three places, paradise. I believe this will be where Gentiles would be at. And this is, of course, Jews. And we'll see it in Luke 16, we'll turn over there. When an unsaved person died, a wicked person died, they went to hell. When a righteous person died, if they were a Jew, they went here. If they were a Gentile, they went here. Now that's the nether parts of the earth. And that's nobody went directly into the presence of God in the Old Testament. This is where your false cultic teachings come from about people sleeping in the grave. Although I just showed you how a guy's gathered unto his fathers, but he's not buried till later. Same thing with Aaron. We don't have time to turn all these references. Numbers chapter 20, verse 24. Aaron dies up on top of the mountain. He's gathered unto his fathers, but he's not buried till later. Same thing with Moses. So that phrase you read about, gathered unto their fathers, I'm going to go unto my fathers, they're going down here. All right, come over to the book of, go ahead and go to Luke 16. I don't have time to run all the references. Luke 16, Jesus tells us this story, and it's not a parable. So how do you know it's not a parable? Well, number one, the Bible doesn't say it's a parable. Number two, Jesus never names specific individuals when it's a parable. He might say, there was a man that did such and such, and there was a householder, and there was this, and there was that, but he never gives specific names. Luke 16 is literal and real. And this helps us to make sense of the rest of the Bible when you understand that Jesus had to shed his blood on the cross for redemption to be possible for people to enter into the presence of God. And so you have a few exceptions like, you know, Elijah and Moses or Enoch in the Old Testament, but those exceptions prove the rule, they don't disprove it. Look in Luke chapter 16, verse 19. There was a certain rich man, which was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day. There was a certain beggar named Lazarus, which laid at his gate full of sores, desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores. It came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. The rich man also died and was buried, and in hell he lift up his eyes, being in torments, and seeth Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. Now, if Abraham and Lazarus are in the third heaven, how in the world is he looking from hell, which we know from Job 28:5, Psalm 9:17, Psalm 55:14, I think. We know that hell's in the center of the earth. I'm going to give you some more references on that in a minute. How is he looking from here to the third heaven? He's not. He's looking across this thing here. Notice verse number 23, and in hell he lift up his eyes. Notice the soul's got eyes, nose, ears, tongue. The soul looks just like your body. It's shaped just like your body inside of you. It's not just some little peanut thing bouncing around in your head, you know. Dung, 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 dung. Your soul is you. And in hell he lift up his eyes, being in torments, and seeth Abraham afar off, and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. But Abraham said, Son, remember that thou in thy lifetime receivest thy good things, and likewise Lazarus evil things, but now he is comforted, and thou art tormented. And beside all this, between us and you there is a great gulf fixed, so that they which would pass from hence to you cannot, neither can they pass to us that would come from thence. Then he said, I pray thee, therefore, Father, that thou wouldest send him to my father's house. For I have five brethren, that he may testify unto them, lest they also come to this place of torment. And Abraham said unto him, they have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. And he said, Nay, Father Abraham, but if one went unto them from the dead, they will repent. And he said unto him, if they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded that one rose from the dead. So the God's not going to send people back as a ghost to try to tell you something. That's a bunch of satanic hogwash. All right, come over to the book of Matthew. Flip over to the left, Matthew chapter 12. The Jehovah's Witness try to tell you when you die, you go in the grave and sleep. Your body sleeps. Jesus even says that Lazarus was asleep when he was dead. It's perfectly biblical to say that the body's asleep, but the soul's absent from the body. And when Rachel. When Rachel dies in Genesis 35, the Bible says her soul was in departing, for she died. Her soul left her body. You don't go down in the grave and sleep. If you go in the grave and sleep, why does Jesus say, fear him which after he hath killed hath power to cast into hell? Is he telling you to be afraid of the people that dig the holes out there at the cemetery? No, he's saying that after you die, your soul's going to leave your body and either be comforted or either be tormented. What did I tell you? Matthew chapter 12. Notice Christ's statement about what's going to take place when he dies on the cross and is buried. Verse 40. He mentions the sign of Jonah in verse 39. Verse 40, as Jonas was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights, look at this, in the heart of the earth. All right, come over to Ephesians chapter number 4. If you don't get all this, just jot the references down so you can go back and look at them. 1 Peter chapter 2 and Ephesians 4. Look in Ephesians 4 and then we'll go to 1 Peter. Ephesians chapter number 4. Come down, if you will, to verse number 7. Ephesians 4, 7. But unto every one of us is given grace according to the measure of the gift of Christ. Wherefore he saith, when he ascended up on high, he led captivity captive. Okay? He ascended. You remember Acts chapter number 1? They stood by and then he ascended. He led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men. Now that he ascended, what is it but that he also descended first into the lower parts of the earth? He that descended is the same also that ascended up far above all heavens that he might fill all things. All right, come over to 1 Peter chapter number 3. And we'll look in Revelation 1, I think. 1 Peter chapter number 3, verse 18. 1 Peter 3, 18. For Christ also hath once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but quickened by the Spirit, by which also he went and preached unto the spirits in prison, which sometimes were disobedient, when once the longsuffering of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was preparing, wherein few that is eight souls were saved by water. So he went and preached to the spirits in prison. So he mentions about people in prison, and he mentions about leading captivity captive. Two more places. Go to Matthew 27, and then we'll look in Revelation 1. Matthew 27. Now just because he preached to disobedient rebels that rebelled in the days of Noah doesn't mean they were saved. Obviously, you've got a declaration of their judgment and justice taking place, but you also have preaching of a deliverance to captives. Matthew chapter 27, notice this, when Christ dies on the cross, look in verse number 50, Matthew 27, 50. Jesus, when he cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. And behold, the veil in the temple was rent in twain, look at this, from the top to the bottom. If a man did it, he'd have to start from the bottom and go to the top. God pulls that veil back. And the earth did quake, and the rocks rent, and the graves were open, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose, and came out of the graves after his resurrection, and went into the holy city and appeared unto many. So there's a resurrection, there's a deliverance of some of these people that were down here. It doesn't say all of them. It doesn't say all of them because there's still a future resurrection that's going to take place with those Jews that will go into the millennial kingdom. Remember when Peter's preaching in Acts chapter 2, he says David's sepulcher is with us unto this day. David is said to be one of the princes that's ruling in the millennium in the book of Ezekiel. So it doesn't mean everybody came up, but what it does mean is that you've got at least the deliverance of the souls. You have a literal resurrection of many that come up for a witness and a testimony to the Jews, but you've got a deliverance of the souls because now the blood of Christ has been shed. Look over in Revelation chapter 1. One more place. I didn't give you all the references. I'm sorry. We got to give you this one. Acts 2. I mentioned Acts 2, but here's what you want to understand. A lot of people try to go to Greek and Hebrew. You don't need Greek and Hebrew. Hades and Sheol and Kibar and all that. You want to understand that this whole area, the netherworld itself is referred to as hell. The whole thing, including those that are down here, just in a general sense. But then there's a division of this stuff. The wicked shall be turned into hell. Righteous people aren't going to there. Look over here in Acts chapter number 2. Acts chapter number 2. You read Matthew 12, verse number 40. Remember he said, as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the whale, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. Look at the prophecy, Acts chapter 2, verse 25. Quoting from the book of Psalms, I think Psalm 16 maybe. David speaketh concerning him, I foresaw the Lord always before my face, for he is on my right hand that I should not be moved. Therefore did my heart rejoice and my tongue was glad. Moreover also my flesh shall rest in hope, because thou wilt not leave my soul in hell, neither wilt thou suffer thine Holy One to see corruption. Soul and body. You see that? Now, who's he talking about? Verse 29, men and brethren, let me freely speak unto you, the patriarch David. He is both dead and buried, and his sepulcher is with us unto this day. Therefore, being a prophet, and knowing that God hath sworn with an oath to him, that of the fruit of his loins according to the flesh, he would raise up Christ to sit on his throne. He, seeing this before, spake of the resurrection of Christ, that his soul was not left in hell, neither his flesh did see corruption. So we have Jesus Christ's body is on the cross when he dies. He gets put into the ground. The Bible says he commended his spirit back to God, and his soul goes down into here, and he delivers captivity captive. How do you know that? One more place, and we're done. Revelation 1. Here's what you want to know about the old Apostles' Creed talks about Jesus descended into hell, and that's true. But what you want to understand about the suffering of Jesus, it's not that Jesus dies and 3 days and three nights he's burning in hell. You don't want to, that's not true. But when he's on the cross, he makes a statement. When the lights go out, he says, I thirst. He is suffering the wrath of God just like a person burning in hell. Matter of fact, he says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And he is paying that punishment of God's wrath on his soul. Isaiah 53, thou will make his soul an offering for sin. And so you talk about suffering. He didn't just suffer in the flesh. His soul was made an offering for us. All right, Revelation chapter number 1. But when he goes in the center of the earth, he delivers the captives. That's what he does. And notice what he says to John in Revelation 1, look in verse 18 or 17. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead, and he laid his right hand upon me, saying unto me, fear not, I am the first and the last. I am he that liveth and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. Amen. Look at this. And have the keys of hell and death. So when we talk about the underworld and things in the Old Testament, you want to realize before Calvary, Hebrews chapter 8, the blood of bulls and goats couldn't cleanse sin. It takes the blood of Christ to get these people out of here. They were in the netherworld. That's why it talks about spirits and things coming up from down there. All right, hope it didn't confuse you too bad. If you got questions, don't hesitate to ask me about it. We'll stop there for this morning.